this hour's top stories, Russia dismisses as interference the Western countries' criticism of a prison sentence for Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. Political crisis deepens in Italy as talks on forming a new government fail following last week's resignation of Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte. Also in the headlines, data shows that the new coronavirus has killed more than 100,000 people in the U.S. so far this year. Welcome to the World News. Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny's sentencing in Russia is drawing strong reactions from the West. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen and EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell condemned the ruling. Several European countries, including France, Germany, and Britain, have called for Navalny's immediate release. The U.S. also said it'll work closely with its allies to hold Moscow accountable. In the meantime, Russian Foreign Ministry described the calls as disconnected from reality and tantamount to interfering in Moscow's internal affairs. Navalny was sentenced to 3.5 years in jail over the charge of violating the terms of his parole. He was arrested last week after returning from Germany, where he had been receiving treatment for alleged poisoning in Russia. Journalist and commentator Max Perry says the West's criticism of Russia is hypocritical.
Yeah, I mean, the hypocrisy is just astounding. And actually, the one thing that really never gets discussed is that Mr. Navalny is not only an inauthentic opposition figure, the Communist Party is really the big opposition. He has less than 5% support. And now he's just rebranded himself as this sort of liberal Kremlin critic, when it's, you know, he's really just sort of whatever is politically convenient or whatever his Western handlers are telling him to be. So, yeah, no, the hypocrisy is astounding. And, you know, it's also been hypocritical, you know, from these EU countries condemning the Russia's crackdown on the protests, when this past year we've seen the way the EU and the United States have brutally cracked down on protest movements in their countries. So, yeah, they have no business meddling in Russia's affairs and should be sorting out their own messes first before they stick their nose in the other countries' business.
The Italian president says he wants to appoint a new government after talks aimed at reviving the previous coalition failed. Sergio Mattarella added that he did not want to call early elections, arguing that the country needs a strong administration to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic and the subsequent economic meltdown. He stressed that he wants a high-profile administration with cross-party backing to take office. Mattarella has summoned former European Central Bank President Mario Draghi, who's expected to be asked to lead a government of national unity. The ruling coalition of Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte collapsed last month after former Premier Matteo Renzi pulled out his Italia Viva party. They accused Conte of mishandling the health emergency and the subsequent economic crisis. Earlier, we were joined by our Rome correspondent Max Cibili for more on Italy's political impasse.
Many have dubbed the government setback as the failure of Italian politics. After talks between the ruling parties failed to patch things up, in a televised speech aired a couple of hours ago, the President Mattarella announced that he would help form a high-profile government that should not identify itself with any political formula. Mr. Mattarella said that if a new government could not be formed, then Italy would have to hold early elections, a move that he said would not only create even more political uncertainty at a time of serious crisis, but it would also risk spreading the virus among voters. Italy cannot wait any longer. The country desperately needs the 220 billion euros of the European Union recovery fund, and to access the funds, the country needs a government. Many are wondering why former Prime Minister Renzi, who is the mastermind behind this government crisis, abruptly pulled his small party out of the ruling coalition. Some have said for a personal gain, some others said that Renzi has been instrumental to capitalist powers, because at this particular conjunction, at the time when the country is about to receive hundreds of billions of euros from Brussels, Italy must have a government led by a man who truly is a man of the European Union, such as Mario Draghi, to allocate the resources to the right projects.
EU lawmakers describe conditions for thousands of refugees on five Greek islands as appalling, a shameful reflection on the bloc's values. EU member states are refusing to relocate these desperate people in defiance of international law. Jerome Hughes is in Brussels with a report.
17,005. That's the precise number of refugees currently barely surviving in awful conditions on the islands of Greece, apparently a proud member of the 27-nation EU. Legislators have been discussing the situation here in the European Parliament, Brussels.
Most of the time, people are locked up in the camps. Does the Commission think this is imprisonment? And if not, what is the difference between this and imprisonment?
There are not enough toilets or hot showers in the overcrowded camps. EU lawmakers say this is all the more appalling against the backdrop of a global pandemic.
Tents have been set up in October, and only in January they start winterization, as if the arrival of winter was a big surprise. And they're tense. It's very basic.
The Parliament debate heard that 60% of the refugees have reported suicidal thoughts to doctors. On Lesbos alone, there are 129 babies under the age of one. EU nations pledged to take in 5,145 refugees from the islands, but just half that number have been relocated.
There are many people who have now been granted international protection who are still stuck in the camps. What's going to happen with them? Do we have commitment by other member states to take over people, and why is this not happening?
The argument has been made the EU has a special responsibility in this regard because of the very destabilizing roles some of the bloc's countries have played in Africa and in the Middle East.
The shape of the current political landscape in the EU does not inject confidence that the bloc's asylum policy will change anytime soon, according to experts.
There is across Europe now this sense that that of xenophobia, of populism, a resistance to seeing more migration. So it makes it very, very tough to do.
Lawmakers say EU governments are using the pandemic as a reason to extricate themselves from their fundamental human rights responsibilities. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Moving on now, the United States has reported more than 100,000 COVID-19 deaths since the 1st of January 2021. According to Johns Hopkins University, the virus has claimed nearly 447,000 lives in the country since the first fatality was reported nearly a year ago. Confirmed cases of the novel coronavirus have also risen to over 26.4 million, despite mass vaccination programs being underway in the virus-stricken U.S. The country remains the world's worst hit in terms of both infections and fatalities. Meanwhile, the overall global deaths from the virus have surpassed 2.2 million, and the total number of infected people is nearing 104 million. The World Health Organization has warned that nationalism in the provision of vaccines will have adverse effects on the ongoing coronavirus crisis. The WHO Director General says weak cooperation between nations is a major barrier to achieving worldwide vaccination at the scale needed to end the coronavirus pandemic. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus also noted that allowing the majority of the world's population to go unvaccinated will not only perpetuate illness and fatalities, but also cause new virus mutations. Ghebreyesus also expressed concern regarding the current manufacturing capacity, stating that production only meets a fraction of the global need. The remarks come as only some 100 million people around the world have so far been vaccinated, with most jabs being administered in wealthier countries. The new data from the COVID vaccination process in the U.S. shows blacks and Hispanics are being inoculated at a slower rate than their white American counterparts. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has found the trend in its first analysis. The following report explores the grim details of how long-standing disparities have been exacerbated by this pandemic.
Almost 7 weeks after the start of the vaccine rollout in the United States, The early data from the COVID vaccination process reveals African Americans and Hispanics, even those working as first responders, are left behind in the vaccination drive. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention examined two priority groups for receiving the first wave of COVID vaccinations. The examined groups were healthcare workers and nursing home residents. According to the CDC, blacks received over 5% of the jabs despite making up 16% of healthcare workforce and 14% of nursing home residents. Similarly, Hispanics, who make up 11% of healthcare workers, received over 5% of shots. This is while white Americans received over 60% of the shots and accounted for 60% of healthcare workers. The previous CDC data also revealed that black, non-Hispanic, and Asian healthcare workers in the country were more likely to contract COVID-19 and die from it than white workers. Ironically, America's black and Hispanic communities are bearing the brunt of the coronavirus pandemic and its economic fallout since its emergence in January last year. They have faced alarming rates of infections and deaths in some states. The trend is particularly visible in the recent CDC analysis, which suggests blacks, Hispanics, and Native Americans died at nearly 3 times the rate of white Americans. Health officials have sounded the alarm for months, broadly calling for equity in vaccine distribution and access to the health care. Some experts also say the trend won't change unless the compounding factors that put these groups in disadvantage are addressed. The latest revelation of disparity is just the tip of the iceberg, as minorities in the U.S. have been facing racial bias, even in healthcare, for decades.
Well, I wouldn't say it's surprising. There has been a generational disparity from decade to decade when it comes to medical care for black Americans and Latinos. We can go back as far as the founding of this country, where there were people who were injured from the black community, whether it was from beatings and they were left to die on their own without medical treatment. Fast forward all the way into the 21st century, and we're still seeing these disparities when it comes to the treatment of not just people who are getting vaccinated, but from people who are exposed to COVID-19.
It seems marginalized and minoritized patients have and will suffer more acutely during the COVID-19 crisis in the U.S. because of decades-old bias towards the people of color. The coronavirus has once again unmasked the systematic racism, inequality, and racial gap, putting a question mark on the United States' dogma of being a just and equal society.
U.S. President signs 3 executive orders in a move to reverse his predecessor's so-called zero-tolerance strategy on immigration.
What I'm doing is taking on the issues that 99% of them that the last president of the United States issued executive orders I thought were very counterproductive to our security, counterproductive to who we are as a country, particularly in the area of immigration. This is about how America is safer, stronger, more prosperous when we have a fair, orderly, and humane legal immigration system.
Biden ordered a review of asylum processing at a Mexico border. He blasted the Donald Trump-era move to separate families at the border as a moral and national shame and created a task force to reunite migrant families. Biden also ordered a review of the migrant protection protocols that ordered asylum seekers to wait in Mexico for their U.S. court hearings. Meanwhile, Biden called for a review of the so-called public charge rule, which makes it harder for poorer immigrants to obtain permanent residency. Now, Washington has reacted to comments made by the Iranian foreign minister, saying the European Union could choreograph the process of revival of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal.
When it comes to the propositions that have been put on the table, I would just go back to the proposition that we've put on the table. That President Biden on the campaign trail, and more recently, President Biden as President of the United States, Secretary Blinken as Secretary of State, have set. When it comes to the JCPOA, we are prepared to walk the path of diplomacy if Iran resumes that full compliance.
Fry said the U.S. would try to extend the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action by including Iran's ballistic missile program in future negotiations, an idea Tehran has always rejected. Earlier, an EU spokesman said the bloc is pressing the U.S. to lift sanctions on Tehran and is working hard to keep the JCPOA alive. The remarks came after Iran's top diplomat, Mohammad Javad Zarif, said the EU could synchronize a coordinated revival of the agreement. Washington unilaterally withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018. In response, Tehran scaled back its commitments. The Islamic Republic says it will reverse those steps once all parties honor their obligations. China and the UK are at odds as London has opened a visa program for Hong Kongers holding the British National Overseas Passport. The UK first announced the program last year following China's new security law in Hong Kong. Britain says the legislation curtails freedoms in the city. China rejects this.
When the United Kingdom handed over control of Hong Kong back to the Chinese in July 1997, various agreements were made in order for the island to maintain some kind of autonomy. However, over two decades later, Hong Kong is very much an integral part of China, and hence why China sees all affairs surrounding the island as sovereign business. Yet, following the implementation of the National Security Law, preventing a variety of crimes, including secession, subversion, terrorism and collusion, the UK promised to issue eligible Hong Kong residents citizenship to Britain, something that Prime Minister Boris Johnson has recently reiterated he will honour. The ability for Hong Kong residents to apply for the special visa may see hundreds of thousands of people apply to travel, live and settle in the UK, and has seen immigration offices in Hong Kong see a surge in demand for applications as the process begins to fall into place.
Since the launch of the BNO visa, our inquiry for the UK migration has about increased at least 30 to 50%, because in the past, for people migrating to the UK, you need to invest at least £2 million, or you have to start a new business in the UK under the Tier 1 entrepreneur. But the BNO visa is a much easier visa, which doesn't require any investment amount.
However, China has taken offence to the offer by the British, with the Chinese Foreign Affairs spokesman Zhao Linjian stating that the move grossly interferes with Chinese internal affairs. He further stated that China will no longer recognise BNO passports as valid travel documents. Furthermore, Chinese authorities are baffled as to why residents would want to leave Hong Kong and head to the UK, claiming that once they arrive there, they'll be considered as second-class citizens, something that China may very well have a point on when one considers the levels of discrimination and racism against foreigners in Britain, meaning that new arrivals could fast become targets of British anti-hospitality, something that the Brits have a long and tarnished record of. What now remains to be seen is just when and how so many new residents will make their way over to the UK, in particular as Britain faces the toughest ever travel measures amongst the peak of the COVID-19 virus, which has already killed in excess of 100,000 British people already.
The question that some ask is, could the UK decision to open its borders to the people of Hong Kong have a hidden agenda? Since the UK has left the European Union, as you know, a large number of Eastern European citizens have left the country. That has made the UK lose an important part of its workforce, with many low-skilled jobs now vacant. So could the surge in new faces from Hong Kong be destined to fill that gap? The measure by the British government could also have a negative impact on its relations with Beijing. That comes as ties have already been soured over the UK's ban on Chinese 5G equipment. The UK put the ban in July of last year.
Epic. Glory.
Glory.
honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Limelight. Former U.S. President Donald J. Trump has abruptly parted ways with five lawyers handling his impeachment defense, just over a week before the Senate trial is set to begin. People familiar with the situation said on Saturday. Those departures include his lead lawyer, Butch Bowers, whose hiring was announced last week, a person familiar with the situation said. Four other lawyers who were reported to be joining, including Deborah Barbier, a criminal defense lawyer in South Carolina, are also leaving, according to multiple people familiar with the situation. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Maggie Haberman. The piece is titled, Trump Parts Ways with Five Lawyers Handling Impeachment Defense. Stay with us for more of Maggie Haberman's article. Former U.S. President Donald J. Trump has abruptly parted ways with five lawyers handling his impeachment defense, just over a week before the Senate trial is set to begin, people familiar with the situation said on Saturday. Those departures include his lead lawyer, Butch Bowers, whose hiring was announced last week, a person familiar with the situation said. Four other lawyers who were reported to be joining, including Deborah Barbier, a criminal defense lawyer in South Carolina, are also leaving, according to multiple people familiar with the situation. Donald Trump had pushed for his defense team to focus on his baseless claim that the election was stolen from him, one person familiar with the situation said. A person close to Donald Trump disputed that was the case, but acknowledged that there were differences in opinion about the defense strategy. However, Donald Trump has insisted that the case is simple and has told advisers he could argue it himself and save the money on lawyers. Trump's aides contend he's not seriously contemplating doing so. The decision for Butch Bowers to leave was mutual, another person familiar with the situation said, adding that Donald Trump and Butch Bowers had no chemistry, a quality the former president generally prizes in his relationships. Mr. Trump prefers lawyers who are eager to appear on television to say that he never did anything wrong. Mr. Bowers has been noticeably absent in the news media since his hiring was announced. Jason Miller, a Trump advisor, said that the former president and his aides had not made a final decision on our legal team. Butch Bowers is the only lawyer whom Donald Trump aides had confirmed would defend the former president. Senator Lindsey Graham, a close ally of Donald Trump who represents South Carolina, was said to have helped line up Mr. Bowers, a well-known figure in the political world there who was working to establish a broader team. departures of Butch Bowers and Miss Barbier were previously reported by CNN. A third lawyer, Josh Howard of North Carolina, is also no longer part of Donald Trump's legal team. And two other lawyers from South Carolina, Johnny Gasser and Greg Harris, will also no longer be involved, one of the people familiar with the situation said. Mr. Trump is due to file a response to the House charges by Tuesday. The question of who will represent Donald Trump in his Senate trial has vexed him and his advisers since it became clear that he would become the first American president to be impeached twice. This month, Democrats in the House, joined by 10 Republicans, charged Donald Trump with incitement of insurrection for his role in instigating a violent mob that stormed the Capitol building on 6th of January, as Congress convened to affirm President Biden's victory in November's election. During various investigations, whilst he was in office, Donald Trump has struggled to find or retain lawyers to defend him, and the announcement of Mr. Bowers's hiring capped weeks of frantic searching. Donald Trump's lawyers from his impeachment trial last year are not expected to be involved this time round. They include Jay Sekulow, the former White House counsel, and Pat A. Cipollone, and his deputy Pat Philbin, and another lawyer who worked in the West Wing of the White House, Eric Hirschman. Rudolph Giuliani, who worked as Donald Trump's personal lawyer during the special counsel's investigation into whether the Trump campaign in 2016 had colluded with Russian officials, has made no secret of wanting to defend Mr. Trump in the second impeachment trial. But Mr. Giuliani is a potential witness because he spoke at a rally of Trump supporters on Wednesday, 6th of January, just hours before hundreds of people marched towards the Capitol building and rioted. Almost all of Donald Trump's advisors blamed Rudolph Giuliani, who encouraged Mr. Trump's desire to find ways to overturn the election results and to call their legitimacy into question for the latest impeachment. They also blamed Giuliani in part for Mr. Trump's first impeachment, which was driven by the former president's interest in pursuing Ukraine to investigate the Biden family. Rudolph Giuliani repeatedly encouraged Donald Trump to believe baseless allegations related to Mr. Biden's son, Hunter, and his business activities in Ukraine. The second impeachment trial is set to begin in the Senate on 9th of February. This week, 45 Republican senators voted in support of a measure brought forward by Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, calling the trial unconstitutional because Mr. Trump is no longer in office. That all but five Republican senators voted to challenge the constitutionality of the trial suggested a likely acquittal for Donald Trump. Democrats have pushed back, noting that Donald Trump was impeached by the House while still in office. Still, the question of constitutionality is likely to be a key part of Donald Trump's defense. And his advisors were buoyed by the show of Republican support for the Rand Paul measure, believing it was an indication that Donald Trump would be spared a conviction. The Senate needs a two-thirds majority or 67 votes to convict Mr. Trump, meaning 17 Republicans would need to cross party lines to side with Democrats in finding him guilty. An additional vote, this one requiring a simple majority, would be needed to disqualify Donald Trump from holding office again. Still, most of his aides say they doubt that he will run for office ever again.
food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and on the eve of the blessed birthday anniversary of the Prophet's immaculate daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, let us hear some interesting words from this Lady of Light about the purpose of creation by God Almighty. He originated things, but not from anything that existed before them, and created them without examples to follow. Rather, he created them with his might and dispersed them according to his will. Not for a need did he create them, nor for a benefit for him did he shape them, but to establish his wisdom, bring attention to his obedience, manifest his might, lead his creatures to humbly venerate him, and to exalt his decrees.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar. Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar. Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of this program, The Man Who Changed the World and Who Shaped All Our Tomorrows. The program, of course, is about Imam Khomeini. May God bless his great soul. And we've, in the previous programs, have discussed the personality of the Imam. We spoke a little bit about his life with our expert in the studio, and we've also mentioned several important points that we brought out of this biographical series on this very great man, who is not only the father of the Islamic Revolution, but also the father of what we can call the Islamic Awakening. Because, of course, the consequences and the impact of what Imam Khomeini did here in Iran, of course, is still playing out after his passing away. So, once again, I'd like to introduce our expert who helps us in this discussion and this debate about this very great man, and that is Dr. Hassani, who's also a researcher and an academic. And first of all, I'd like to say salam, and a very warm welcome to you on the program.
Salamu alaikum. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you, brother. May God's blessing be upon you and your family.
Thank you.
Brother, I was listening to you very carefully. Mm-hmm. The name of the program, the title is The Man Who Changed the World. Yes. I was going to suggest something here.
Yes.
The Man Who Changed the World and Still Is.
It still is, yes, yes.
That brings me to another subject. Mm-hmm. That, remember the one of the programs, I said something to the fact that,
yeah,
speaking about Imam Khomeini, it's very easy and very difficult at the same time.
It is easy.
Because if you ask me, mm-hmm, I would like for you to, you know, jump in and ask me tough questions.
Yes.
I'm not going to claim to have the same answer that you may expect to hear.
Sure.
But I can promise you this. If I don't know the answer, I go and do my research, come back,
sure,
to give a good answer in order to be to be validated with the references that you were talking about, Quran and Itra. Remember, yes. We were talking about this in the program, in the last program.
Yes.
The man who changed the world and still is. This is the problem that enemies of Islam have with the character of Imam Khomeini, peace be upon him.
Exactly. I mean, what I was going to ask you, and to be honest, you know, we're really referring to a book that has been recently been published on Imam Khomeini, and it's an anthology. It's the composition of a variety of academics, of scholars, of people who are analysts in this particular field of studying great figures of history, the people who really shape events. And of course, you know, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, has had such an impact that this anthology is about 400 pages, compiled by people of international repute, academics and professors of various expertise, who are literally gobsmacked, if I could put it that way, by the Imam, who was a humble teacher, a student of the Hawza, a man of great purity, of great spirituality. And we discussed that in the previous programs. We discussed this aspect of his being close to his beloved, and he's written poetry accordingly. There are poems by Imam Khomeini about speaking about this mystical aspect of this relationship that he wanted with God, which is very rare, of course, because you and I were discussing before that in the late century, religion was something that was basically put in a closet.
It was a taboo.
Well, I mean, it was not something relevant.
I mean, if you really tried to practice religion back then,
right?
You know, you would, in some different circumstances, you should be ashamed of yourself, according to them.
Yeah, exactly. No, this is
you should feel bad.
Well, I mean,
why are you praying?
Exactly. I mean, the thing that
you don't pray. This is what they used to say.
Yeah, in terms of the West, I mean, as far as you and I, because of course you've lived in America and I've lived in the United Kingdom for most of my life. The thing that draws to us is that, you know, this was a personal thing, you know, that, you know, if you have a spirituality, it's like a phase that you go through, right? But Imam Khomeini was the embodiment of one of the great divine religions that have been revealed to the world, which is Islam. And he comes out of that tradition. And he's made such an impact that he's left the rest of the world still searching and going through all their databases again about exactly what has this man done. And, you know, as you say, as you quite rightly pointed out, the title of the program is The Man Who Changed the World. And what we are puzzled by is the ingredients that make up Imam Khomeini, because we've touched on these aspects of his personality, his character, his courageousness, his bravery in terms of speaking out against Zulm. As far as Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, he was doing his duty as far as the agenda, or as far as the briefing that was concerned from the Quran.
And let's not forget the ingredients, the main ingredients was divine teaching. I'm going to refer to this.
Yeah, exactly. And what I'm saying here is that in terms of this connection between the Prophet's legacy, which the Imam reiterated again in his will at the end of his life, and he says, and he begins by that tradition, that very famous hadith that we quote over and over again, that there are two things that the Holy Prophet was leaving behind. The one was the Quran, and the other was the itrati, the family.
Two heavy things or two valuable things at the same time.
At the same time.
Right.
And the Imam lives up to both of these things.
That's why he became Imam.
That's why he became Imam. So, the question is, why so much emphasis on this legacy for the rest of the Muslim world? And why is, in spite of all the resources that are available to the West, and it was to the East as well, in terms of their intelligence, in terms of their analysis, in terms of their academia, and of course, you know, we don't belittle them in any way. When we speak of Harvard, we speak of Oxford, we speak with respect for these institutions. Yet, why don't they have an answer for Imam Khomeini? Why are they struggling?
My answer to that important question is this: because they are acting.
Right.
If you act, you cannot be yourself. Imam Khomeini was not acting.
Right.
He was himself.
Mm-hmm.
This is one thing. The main ingredients that I said a couple seconds ago,
mm-hmm.
divine teaching,
right.
You talk about Quran here,
mm-hmm.
and who's gonna teach us Quran? Prophet.
Yes.
According
but,
to Quran.
But you don't have Prophet just now.
Well, but he has done his mission.
Mm-hmm.
During 23 years of hardship.
So that we wouldn't be without him.
Because he did it because we shouldn't go astray after him.
Exactly. And I was
we should stay on the right path. And Imam Khomeini,
mm-hmm.
peace be upon him, did that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I want to give you so many references from Quran, okay?
Right, go ahead.
Let me give you examples.
Right, let's,
because
let's put this into our context.
When you study Imam Khomeini's life,
yeah.
okay,
mm-hmm.
this is not a lullaby for us.
Yeah.
This is something for us to pick the reference, the passage, the address. Why are we supposed to do this or that? When you hear about what Imam... Let me give you one example.
Sure.
It is said that Imam Khomeini, peace be upon him, when he was thirsty,
mm-hmm.
you know, asking for a glass of water, whatever,
mm-hmm.
okay, he drank half of it. He put a piece of napkin on top
mm-hmm.
to save the rest of water
mm-hmm.
for later on. Why he did that? We don't think about it. We said, oh,
mm-hmm.
we're looking for some different reasons. No, we have to get back to the passage, to the divine teaching. Quran tells us, Kulu vashrabu wa la tusrifu. Eat, drink,
mm-hmm.
but don't waste. Imam Khomeini was not acting for someone to take a picture or later on, you know, write it in a
right.
book.
Yeah.
To be a biography of him or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
He really believed in this ayah, that wasting the benefit, the gifts of God is not good.
Well, I want
as simple as that.
I want to interrupt you there just for a second, because what you point out there, you know, we hear this cliche over and over again. Islam is a way of life.
And but the problem with that is you don't get tired of it.
Yeah, this is a way of life. Islam is a way of life. But what I want to say is, how many of us actually live that way of life or have understood that way of life? I mean, the action you've just described there for a moment with the half glass of water in the napkin, I mean, also reminds me of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, where he says, when you're doing your ablutions, you can do it with a glass of water.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You don't need to open the tap and let it run and wash your face and have a kind of semi-bath before you go for your prayer.
Because if you do so, if you waste it, that's some kind of selfishness.
So exactly. So in other words, Imam Khomeini is literally taking what he's understood from the Quran, and although was not a masoom, but he's trying to live up to the standard of the infallibles, the 12 imams who succeeded the Holy Prophet in terms of that teaching. Because that discipline is extremely important. And if you don't have it, you can't live this way of a life of Islam.
That's why he was successful. That's why he ruled over the hearts, not bodies. This is the task of Islam. Before you conquer a country or a land, you have to gain the hearts. This is very difficult. Imam was not masoom by any means, but this is not the point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in Shia belief,
mm-hmm.
we only have 14 of them.
Yes.
But let me ask you this. Hazrat Zainab, peace be upon her,
mm-hmm.
she wasn't masoom in this category.
No.
But what kind of wrongdoing she did?
Exactly.
This is a question. This is why I'm trying to say, to relay the message. If you read Quran, in every different passage of teaching, it tells you why don't you think in so many different levels.
Yes.
We have tafakkur,
mm-hmm.
okay, this is the beginning.
Yes.
Then we have ta'aqul,
mm-hmm.
it goes to a higher level,
then
we have tadabbur. You have to put the pieces in order, one behind each other. Mm-hmm. In other words, you have to make a caravan of thinking, of rationalizing, of understanding, deep understanding of divine teaching. And Imam did that successfully. Imam was not impeccable in that sense, but he climbed to the summit and to the top of all the perfection that we could expect from a human being. This is my point. And I can give you so many different... Look, there's a verse in Quran in chapter Anfal, the spoils of war.
Spoils of war, yes. This is verse, chapter 8, isn't
it? Exactly. The verse 29 says, Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O those who believe. After that, there is a conditional statement. In tattaqullah. If, and that's a big if, I should say. If you fear God by staying away from what he prevents you not to do.
Prohibits you from not
prohibits
doing.
Prohibits you from not doing. Doing. And do what he's supposed to expect from you.
Sure.
So you become a pious.
Pious,
when you become a pious, there is a reward. In tattaqullah, what's the reward? Yaj'al lakum furqana. God gives you a power of distinction.
Right.
Imam was a distinctive man. This is a divine teaching that I'm talking about. And Prophet, peace be upon him, passed this to us. Why? Because his divine mission was complete. He did exactly what God told him to do.
I mean, the thing is that, as you quite rightly point out, that this very important factor, that Imam Khomeini is actually living this divine teaching, which gives him this naturalness, this sincerity, this purity, both of his words and his action.
And by the way, he didn't do it for other people to see him.
Exactly.
He did it because he believed it.
He believes it. And
that's the difference.
That's the decisive factor.
That's why I keep saying he was not acting. He was himself. And by himself, I mean he was human first. Then, of course, he was a faithful. He was a Muslim. He was a Shia, because all different levels, you know, the expectation goes higher. He raised the bar for himself, Brother Ajaz. He raised the bar for himself. This is very important to understand.
And he was doing that to the last moment of his life. Raising the bar.
Let me give you another instant of his life.
Please.
Okay, he was walking in his surrounding. One small garden, one small flower. How many of us pay attention to a small flower, the changing of how it grows? Imam did that. So for us to see that, to read that, is one thing. But to think about it is different. Because he saw that particular small flower as ayah of Allah, as the sign of Allah.
Exactly.
The color, the smell, the beauty of the flower. He felt it. Because Allah told him to think about his gifts, his creation. Remember the incident that is famous, that one of the correspondents, the media, asked him in the plane, what is your feeling?
Yeah, that
after?
Was John Simpson of the BBC.
What? The answer was what? Nothing.
Nothing.
My question to you is this. Why he didn't ask him, what do you mean by nothing? Think about what I just said.
Yeah. He didn't come back to him on that.
He didn't come back to him. Yeah. Why? Because he wasn't thinking. Then later on he took it in a negative way.
Way,
And talk about it.
Yeah.
This is my point.
Yeah.
And you can elaborate on this if you want.
Yeah.
By thinking. What is your feeling after 15 years in being in exile? You're going back to your country, your homeland. What is your feeling? Imam says nothing. Because besides Allah, for Allah, from Allah, to Allah, he sees nothing. That's what he meant. Anything else is just a tool. It's a device. It's not the purpose. It's not the main goal for Imam.
No.
Because the way he recognized his creator, he can see things different than other people. This is the difference.
Exactly. And this is
news reporter, why didn't he ask him, what do you mean by nothing? He could explain.
Yeah.
My answer to you is this, because he didn't want to know.
He didn't want to know, because he was afraid of what was going to be said.
Of course, because if you ask him one question, you know, he gives you another one.
He was afraid if he went into
Brother
that.
Ajaz, there's no end to it.
Yeah, there's no end to it. Because
if you're attached to Islam, if you're a true believer, there is no end for you.
No.
The sky is the limit.
sky's the limit. But the thing is that what the secular West, if I can put it that way, or the fact that the West has, in a sense, gone for secularism and abandoned their religiosity in many ways and spirituality in many ways, it's very hard for them to stomach what Imam Khomeini was saying over those period of the revolution, in the early days of the revolution. And, you know, that's what I come back to this anthology.
My point on that is this. Back then, you could justify that it was something new. Something new was going on.
Yeah.
But how about right now, 34 years later
but
on?
I would go further than that. I wouldn't even say it was something new. I would say...
No, from their own perspective.
From their perspective, I'll give you this. Because the headline in the paper said, you know, as soon as Imam Khomeini had landed at the Furudga, at the airport of Mehrabad, that he said in Tehran, it says 1,000, after 1,400 years, Islam is back. I mean, that's the headline
Islam
in the British
the
papers, which
Islam
means...
Islam was back the way we could see it.
Exactly. But the
Islam always was on the...
That's the way Imam Khomeini, in this anthology, what he's done for all the academics and scholars who were so busy spending billions of dollars of taxpayers' money on justifying the postmodern world and the world that we are in at the moment, which we now see is falling apart. Also, thanks to many aspects that we'll discuss later on in later programs about how Imam Khomeini could have this insight into seeing the end of the East as well as the West in terms of the civilization as they know it. But as far as what we are seeing at the moment, even in this moment in time after what Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, has done, that in the smallest of actions, as you say, in one word where he said heech,
nothing.
They were quite well aware of
what
that heech
was. So
no, let me finish this point, because the thing is that in that heech, they knew perfectly well what that meant.
That one particular
because
word,
they,
nothing, you can write books about it.
Exactly, because this word heech is saying, and that's what John Simpson was afraid of and didn't want to carry on the conversation. And this is what this anthology is also compiled about, that it's going to force him to think about God. And that is where we are at the moment, that you and I are discussing Imam Khomeini, the man who changed the world.
And still is.
But what are we really discussing here? What is the real topic behind what we're discussing here? Because the Imam loves Allah. And that love that he has for God is something that he wants to instill in all of us.
And that love comes from true understanding.
Yeah.
A deep one.
So
what we call ma'rifah.
From the passages of the Quran, as we are saying that we say that Islam is a way of life, but really, are we doing any true justice to living that way of life as the Imam demonstrated that, look, I am a person who has lived this book and
brother,
look what it's done.
We should try. He set the example. You know, we haven't seen any prophets. Have you?
I haven't seen any, no.
Apostles?
But
messengers?
If I want...
We saw Imam Khomeini.
Yeah, exactly.
That's why I said it's easy to talk about Khomeini, because we think we know him. This
we think
point.
We know him, yeah.
We think we know him,
no.
So it makes it easy for us.
Yeah.
To imagine, we know him. Why?
Yeah.
Because we live at the same era, the same time that he did.
Yeah, but we
most of us.
But we didn't grasp...
We didn't.
But
we didn't grasp the importance of...
Of how he lived.
Where he was coming from. How
yeah,
he lived.
How he lived.
The root of the whole thing. And
why is
it difficult to understand Imam Khomeini? Because we don't try.
Yeah.
It is difficult. It's almost impossible for Western media, Western mentality, that is, in order to understand why. Because in order to meet someone, you have to take the first step. You have to meet in the middle.
Yeah.
He comes to you, you have to go to him at the same time.
Yeah.
And this is how God works. He said, if you take one step for me, I would help you.
Yeah, I'll take 10 steps towards you.
Exactly. That's why when you do something good, he rewards you 10 times.
10 times.
Bigger.
Bigger.
More.
Bigger.
But if you do something bad, he only punishes you if he doesn't forgive you.
Yeah.
So this is the point. Mm. This is the stuff that we need to talk about.
Yeah.
And the list goes on.
Yeah.
We can talk about Imam Khomeini as long as we can live. Why? Because Quran is limitless.
Exactly.
Because Etra is limitless.
Exactly.
Because they set the right path for us. On this, I can give you so many different passages and action that Imam took. Remember Shuar Nazir?
Yes, I remember.
Edward?
Yeah.
The Soviet Union Foreign Minister, remember, after Imam sent a mission,
yeah.
a divine mission, I should say.
Yeah.
Okay, one of the big scholar of the Hosa of in Qom.
Yeah.
He sent with the message in order to explain it to Mr. Gorbachev. He didn't listen. Later on, he admitted.
Yeah.
That was one of his biggest mistakes in his life.
It says that also here, it quotes him from this anthology. He said, that was the biggest mistake of my life. I wish I had paid more attention to that delegation when they when they left that message. Because he says, when the Soviet Empire really started to disintegrate, I remembered that letter.
Mm-hmm. But that was too late. So one of the divine teaching, Brother Edwards, is that to be on the right track at the right time. Imam was at the right time, acting at the right time. He wasn't late. When Shuar Nazir came to him with the message of Mr. Gorbachev, I think we pointed out. You know what he did?
Yeah.
The way that he met him. Mm. He didn't sit Imam Khomeini. Mm. I tell you why. Anything you hear about Khomeini, ask yourself why. Why he did that?
Mm.
Just like the example I gave you about the glass of water.
Mm.
Why he did that? There is a reason behind it. The reason you should look for to understand in Quran and Itra, in the life of the impeccables.
Yes.
When Shuar Nazir came to him, he didn't sit on a chair for Shuar Nazir to arrive into the room and for Imam Khomeini, as the leader of Muslims of the world, to stand up in front of someone who's not a Muslim. Think about what I just said.
Yeah.
Because you talk about the Izzah here.
Mm.
You talk about the leadership.
Mm.
Okay, he was humble. You mentioned something, you know,
yes.
a couple minutes ago.
Yeah.
You said he was humble.
Mm.
He was humble because God told him to be humble.
Exactly.
There's a passage in Quran
yes.
telling his prophet, peace be upon him. He said, when you walk on the earth, don't be arrogant. Don't walk like a king. Imam was humble with the, how should I say this, with faithful. He wasn't humble with America. He said, America cannot do a damn thing. He was tough with them because, again, in Quran, God tells us, you know,
be hard against the unbelievers.
Prophet is the messenger of God, okay, our prophet, peace be upon him. Whoever is with him, ashadda ala al-kuffar, tough with the enemy of God, with the blasphemous.
Yes.
But at the same time, rohamao bainahum, be gentle, be kind, be meek. He was meek. With people, ordinary people.
Exactly.
But he couldn't budge in front of infidel, in front of God.
No.
He shouldn't. He couldn't.
Couldn't.
He couldn't.
No.
Because that was against his belief. And the list goes on, brother. He didn't stand up in front of him. So the set was like this, that Shuar Nazir was sitting.
Yes.
Imam arrived into the room. Think about that.
Mm.
From the position of Izzah, undefeatable position that God gives every single faithful, if you follow the path.
Yeah.
You see my point here?
Yeah.
Anything he did, anything you read in a book, don't just read it because it's a story of his life, which is good.
Yeah.
And we should respect.
Mm.
But think